Hello, welcome to the House of Inner Tranquility podcast. My name's Brother Theo. I'm a monk at the Monastery of Absolute Harmony. I'm here with Paul Harris, the spiritual director and principal teacher at the Meditation Centre. Together we're going to talk about full-time monastic training and the Buddha's teaching in general. So we set some time aside today to talk about why people might want to come in for full-time training.
Well, we both did.
Yes. You a lot longer ago than I did.
Mm-hmm.
So might be a good time later to compare notes and, you know, look at our different experiences.
Yeah.
See what that's like. But just to start with, I think maybe a good thing for listeners would be to know what the conditions are. So why, what would people need for them to consider that as an option?
Okay, I guess there are many reasons why people would quite like to live in a monastic environment. I mean, it is a, what did my brother call it when he came in to visit, a secluded nook. I mean, it is like a hermitage, isn't it? Mm. It's, you know, you're out of the pell-mell, the regular pell-mell of life. You do have to work, but the work is specific and is kept in balance with meditation. But it is a very nice way of life if you don't require a lot of sensory stimulation. Mm. If you've reached a point, I mean, it is a serious spiritual environment, and we can talk about the necessary conditions that people have to have in order to be able to come in. But it is a in many senses a spiritual pressure cooker. It magnifies mental behaviour because you don't have the escape routes that TV, internet, going out to the cinema or going out to the restaurant will give you. All of that is taken away. Mm. So it is a recluseship. Mm. So it's going to suit somebody who recognises that and understands why it's like that. But we can, you know, we can talk formally about the necessary conditions. You can't be wanted by the police. You can't have any court injunctions outstanding. You know. So you can't just enter into the monastery to escape the law.
Yeah.
You can't have dependents. So if there are people who are depending on you, like children, you are expected to be paying maintenance, you have to pay maintenance. You can't come in, you have to provide. So if you're married, obviously you can't come in. And you have to be free of illnesses as well. So you have to be fit and healthy when you come in.
Hmm.
Is there another one? I can't
remember. I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I can say from being here, you can't be hobbling around with a walking stick or a Zimmer frame. You've got to have a certain vitality
Yes, and if you know, because another reason that somebody might come in is like they're not well, and this way they'd ensure that they get looked after.
Yes.
So it's really about looking at your intentions.
Yes.
Behind, I mean, there was one chap who wanted to come in, and it was really clear, although he didn't explicitly state it was very clear that actually he wanted it because it would be nice and quiet and he'd be able to do his own thing. And then so I sort of just pointed out that as part of the training, people were trained to do public talks.
Yeah.
And I never saw him again. There was another chap who wanted to come in, but he wanted to bring his Taoism with him, and he wanted to study Taoism while he was here.
Yes.
And it took me quite a few goes to get the message across that actually, no, we're a Buddhist meditation centre. We practice Vipassana, insight meditation.
Yeah.
And everyone who comes in for training, they come in with the acknowledgement that they are there to accept instruction. It is a monastic order after all.
Mm.
And there are expectations around the way people behave.
Yeah.
And so again, once the message got through, he realised that, you know, it wasn't compatible.
kind of leads to an interesting point, doesn't it, about how I suppose the public perception of being a monk or a nun. I suppose in my mind, before I came in here, I thought of kind of friars and Benedictine monks in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
And it's not like that.
name of the rose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think there's something about dispelling myths, maybe, that quite early on when people come in, they might have ideas that aren't particularly accurate.
Yeah, so I certainly think that people around me, when I came in, had assumptions about what... I felt that when I came in, I was actually free of a lot of those assumptions. The reason I came in was that I suffered, and I understood that the Buddha's teaching did indeed lead to the realization of the cessation of suffering. I had gone through this reflection of recognizing that my best chance... One of the thoughts I remember having was, my best chance of practicing right livelihood was if I became a monk.
Mm.
It was only once I'd become a monk that I realised that there's right and wrong livelihood for a monk.
Yes.
But it was a recognition, I think, that, you know, it is possible to get the best supporting conditions for following the Noble Eightfold Path.
Yes.
And so that was my driving force. Now, I wouldn't expect people around me to understand where I was in terms of suffering and the being conscious of suffering, where I was in terms of my spiritual development, what I needed. So my path was coming to meet Alan, and within Alan James, who was the founder of the centre, and within an hour, having accepted that I was leaving the world completely and I was coming in as a monk, and he just flung the door right open for me. I understood when I was walking down the hill to catch the train to go back to Bristol that people around me wouldn't understand, that they would have their assumptions about what it was, and that nothing I would say would necessarily dispel those. And quite frankly, I didn't care.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess there are assumptions. You're just escaping from responsibility.
Yeah.
Ha ha. What it was actually was me finally taking responsibility.
Yes, yes.
I think it's the same for you as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And in a very kind of in a positive way, in a way that you can really. I think for me, before I came in here, I didn't understand the power of that, and it's almost like I've had to do it to really grasp how powerful that is and how important it is.
Yeah. That's what I mean about it being a spiritual pressure cooker. And the only way really to get on with it is to surrender to the discipline, to surrender to the way of life, to surrender to instruction, to surrender to the way of life, really, completely. Yeah. And then you find that if your intention is that truly you want to follow the way with the best possible supporting conditions, you will get the maximum benefit from that.
Yeah. Okay, so thinking about the type of person that might want to come in, and we've already had a few discussions in the past about kind of what's out there in terms of spiritual training, especially things on the internet. It seems like everyone's kind of got their own guru on their own, you know, they can Google their own guru sort of thing, and there's lots of options, like a big mix of options. But as we've also discussed, that might be slightly deceptive, in that you get this illusion of, you know, having a teacher and a teaching and you're on your way sort of thing. And obviously coming in here and doing kind of what we do, I can say absolutely, in my case, it's a completely different world, and there's a step up in terms of commitment and dedication to this path. So maybe could you talk a little about that?
Yeah, there's nothing like desperation. The analogy I used with me coming in was that my hair was on fire, what remained of it, and that I was desperately searching for a bucket of water that I could put my head in. And so, and that's the way the founders, Alan and Jackie James, set this place up. It was set up for serious spiritual practice. So a lot of the, what I call the spiritual dilettantes, people who want to pick a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and who want to retain their will and their choice as to what they accept and what they don't accept, this wouldn't really... Well, it goes either one or two ways. And that's true of training as a layperson or training as a full-time monk or a nun. The training itself will sort the wheat from the chaff. And it's not saying that this is the only way and that somehow you're not authentic if you don't go down this particular path. But it is saying that it is one hell of a direct way of approaching the problem of suffering and how to overcome it. So naturally, because we're very, very comfortable with people coming in and giving it a try. And if it is that somebody, upon reflection, decides that, no, it's really not the right vehicle for me, it's not the right teaching for me, they go as friends. You know, it's not, we don't think any less of somebody because they decide not to continue with it, and we don't think any more of somebody because they decide to commit to it and take it seriously 24/7. Everyone has to find their path. Everyone's spiritual path is valid. This is just one particular way of going about it. So really, it's sort of, it's encouraging people to say, you can give it a try, and if it genuinely, upon giving it a serious length of time, and so we have like a 3-month noviceship that somebody does before they ordain, and that can be preempted by doing retreats beyond the pandemic, doing retreats and getting a feel for the way we teach, the way the training unfolds here. And so the decision is ultimately that individual's. It's not something that's being compelled. It's that somebody has enough information and enough experience to say, to make a definitive yes, I want this. And that's the perfect way of doing it, because nobody loses that way. So the sort of person that it would appeal to, one of the other conditions is you can't have any kind of debt as well. You've got to be free of debt. So you want to, so it's really going to suit somebody that currently has no money, has no friends, has no job, has no life to speak of. It's really going to appeal to somebody like that. And given the current climate, you know, economic climate, cultural climate, environmental climate, there are going to be people out there that, for whom this is a viable alternative. Because one of the problems, of course, is that people are being educated, young people are being educated, but they don't have the employment opportunities that past generations have had. And so there is this shortfall in terms of life meaning. And what I found when I came in, because I make no bones about it, I didn't have any of the accoutrements of power and success. I didn't have the house, the car, the wife, the kids, the career. I didn't have any of those things. And when I came in for training, I discovered real sense of orientation and direction and meaning in my life. And so therefore, within a few weeks of coming in, I was happier than I'd been in the entirety of my adult life. So if you have to be in a position where you are free of the world sort of pulling you back for some reason, you know, like for instance, like any kind of unfinished business, really. But in terms of character type, well, Buddhism embraces all character types, you know, and you adapt the path to suit the character type.
I was just thinking on the back of what you just said, I could also imagine the person that had gone out and achieved all that and got the house and the family and the, you know, the accoutrements of everything that modern society tells you you need and found it wanting.
Yes.
That I could imagine that kind of person kind of getting something out of coming here.
Yes, and that's going back to the authenticity of the intention, isn't it? And it being couched in a recognition, essentially, of the Buddha's first noble truth, that life is suffering, and that whatever it is that you accumulate, ultimately, you're going to lose anyway. So therefore, it isn't the lasting, even if it gives you the joy, the happiness, the sense of worth in life, you're going to lose it again. And so it is that, and of course, at the end of it all, there's death looming on your shoulder, just ready to
always
ready just to tap you on the shoulder and explain things to you. So for somebody who's reflective in that way, the only difficulty is, of course, one has to be free of those accoutrements.
Yes.
And if you have, like I say, if you have responsibilities, you can't just fling them out. You know, we don't break up relationships. You know.
Okay.
You can't escape. You can't escape your relationship. So, right, I'm going to go off and live in a monastery.
Yes.
You have to face those things.
Yeah.
And one thing I like to remind people who are interested in full-time training but have some kind of obstacle is to include that, say debt, as a for instance, is that's part of your learning.
Yes.
Going and spending however long you need in order to be free of that debt is part of your training. It's developing that determination.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that really, when I've heard you speak like that, it's impressed me a lot, because it entails that the teaching is a lot bigger than just coming in here. You're thinking about people's spiritual progress and well-being, whatever their circumstance. And if they don't, if it's not appropriate for them to come in here, then there's other things they could be looking at in the meantime.
Yes, and you always run the risk of losing somebody as a potential student because that's not what they wanted to hear. But actually, that's what you need to say. And so as a teacher and as a training centre, you have to be free of attachment to people, that people come and go.
Yeah.
Even in your time, I mean, it's a bit weird because we had the whole pandemic thing happen. But in my time here, the makeup of the community at large, and we have a lot of lay students who support the centre, the actual makeup has it's never been static. It's always been in a state of flux. You have a few very core members of that community that have been coming along for years, and occasionally somebody joins that core group of really committed meditators, and then you have this wider group which is always in a state of flux. So it's not, as a spiritual director, as the main teacher, you accept that people do indeed come and go. And some people that you thought were really dedicated, you just stop seeing them completely. Other people, you're scratching your head to see how they're going to benefit from this, and they just blossom.
Yeah.
So it's just no telling.
Yeah.
But you have to have principles, and you have to. Yeah, the teaching is more important than anything else.
Yes.
And we don't dilute. We've changed some of the cultural aspects. Be in harmony with the way that we understand things work in the West. But the Buddha's teaching is a timeless, eternal truth teaching. You don't change any of that. So that is sacrosanct.
Just reminds me of something that I've always wanted to kind of get back to you with, because I remember when I moved, when I first arrived, you mentioned something that sounded a bit cryptic, but I think I knew what you meant, but I just thought I'd kind of run it by you again. Something about sort of the lineage of becoming a monk or a nun. In a way, you're tapping into a long historical tradition, in a way. And I'm not sure if what sense you meant it, but I almost got the sense you were talking about, yeah, in joining this lineage, this tradition, you get it's strangely, mysteriously supported, or something, you know, things happen for you because of your intention and because of this movement that you're joining, that kind of help you along the way. Am I getting that right? Did you say that?
I can't remember. I say a lot of cryptic things. Yeah, it does sound quite cryptic.
Yeah, yeah. That's just the idea of lineage, like, yeah, belonging to something that's been around for a long time, and you're in a way drawing on that. You know, that's helping you in your progress because you're joining something that's so established.
Yeah, it's really deeply rooted.
Yeah.
No, I'm just thinking about how I was trained by Alan James, and Alan eventually asked me to take over from him as the spiritual director here, and he was trained by the Venerable Capuluado and took up teaching, having completed the training. And the Venerable Capuluado was trained in Thailand at Wat Pak Nam, a very famous and revered teacher. Mm. So there is a lineage. And there is something definitely uncanny about the way in which the centre persists, no matter what the ups and downs, economically or otherwise, that there is this sense, and I think it is because it's steeped in tamma, and Buddha tamma is the truth teaching. So the centre is running in harmony with the laws that govern existence. Mm. And the whole idea of the training is to discover those laws of existence oneself. Mm. That's what sets you free. And so the centre from its inception has been run on the lines of Dhamma, truth. Mm. And so as long as you honour that and you behave in accordance with that, and of course you have all the monastic rules to help enable you, to understand what the laws of life are, and also to help you break them, to actually see what happens.
Yes.
Because you can't help it. The rules, the monastic rules are set up in such a way that you cannot fail but fall foul of them from time to time.
Yeah.
Because part of the idea is letting go of all the hubris and spiritual pride about, you know, being special.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we have a system of keeping people honest. You have the reading of the monastic rules at the full moon, and then there's the confession, where there's the acknowledgement of breaking of rules to your preceptor, and that enables you, the head monk, Brother Nigel, and that enables you to not to have to keep secrets, you're completely exonerated in that moment because it's been verbally expressed, you've acknowledged it, and then, you know, whatever these breakers of rules have been written on is then ripped up into small shreds, and we go, away, and it's all gone, because things arise and pass away. Mm. So that way, a monk or nun lives unburdened psychologically. So, and that's really deep. All these aspects of the training that we can talk about, they run very, very deep. Mm. What is the expression? Deep waters. Still waters run deep. That's it. So, one of the things that anyone coming into full-time training has to realise is that people don't understand. They just see you doing nothing. Unless you happen to be cleaning or cooking or doing something in the garden. Mm. You're just sitting there doing nothing. Mm. How are you contributing? But you're contributing in the most profound way. Mm. It's not being seen. Mm. So I can't remember what your original question was now, but it's that whole idea that you're entering into something which is actually very deep.
Yes, and also that you're not going to find in an outside environment. Those qualities and principles that you're talking about there are kind of rare in mainstream society. This idea of accountability and honesty and, you know,
I'd say not only does it not appear to be there, that people seem to be actively going in another direction. And the degree to which life is becoming ever more insufferable and people are becoming ever more anxious and worried and afraid is demonstrated by that. So, but there's always coming back the other way. So we might find that in life generally there might be a revivalism in traditional spiritual and religious attitudes, because if it goes too far down the way of letting go of all traditions, letting go of all rootedness in ancient traditions, then people will experience more and more existential angst, and that sense of separation will be ever, you know, ever present. So that suffering and that causes them people to reflect. So in a way, you don't want the rest of the world to be ultra spiritual. No, people, we are part of the world. That's the thing. We're not separate from the world. But this is where somebody comes to do this kind of work.
And
things are set up in a way as to be as balanced, equanimous, tranquil as they can be.
That kind of leads on to my next question about the sense we're not a bubble, we are connected to the community, certainly in you know, the way that we practice is we have a lay community, and there's this strong connection between the full-time members here and the lay community. Could you talk a bit about that and the value of it?
Yeah, again, it's deep. It's the tradition, you know, from the Buddha's day, that the lay people who are committed to living a worldly life, raising a family, generating wealth, and so forth, they are ones that provide the material support for the full-time community. They do so out of faith. They do so out of their recognition that their actions have results and wanting to perform wholesome actions. So supporting a monastic order is a very good karma. That allows the full-time community to train full-time, to get further ahead in terms of their understanding of the teaching, an experiential understanding of the teaching, to get insight knowledges, to come to understand life as it really is. And they then can teach other people how to get free of suffering. So the full-time community then are the ones that provide the facilities for lay people to come in and do retreats, because we're a monastic centre, we're also a retreat centre, we're also a meditation centre for a local community that come in again post-pandemic, hopefully we'll be coming back again, for regular meetings and events. So there's a whole package that the full-time community, and this is the beautiful thing, it's just such a virtuous circle that's created, because the full-time community develop their parami through serving the lay community and ensuring that they get the opportunity to follow the way and practice the way as well. So it just, everyone wins.
So following on from that, I was going to ask you more of a kind of personal question about the, well, the what's happened over the pandemic. You know, obviously your role has changed slightly in that you've become quite an online presence in a way, and lots of people are tuning in twice a week now to hear you, you know, give the teaching in a slightly different context. And I was going to ask you kind of how that's been for you.
I'm happy to do it. I much prefer the fact that the brilliant thing about the way Alan and Jackie set this centre up was that it offers everything. It offers everything from full-time training all the way to introductory classes and workshops and so forth. And I love, what I love about it is that people find us. that, you know, obviously we had a presence online, we had a website and so forth. I'd done occasional interviews online with the BBC and various other things, but it was very sporadic, and I was quite happy with that because the vast majority of my time was spent talking to people who are really here, actually here. So people coming on retreats, people coming for meditation interviews, doing classes, running workshops, and I'm very comfortable with that more local kind of reach. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to save the world, you know, it's just fine. That, but something has intervened beyond anyone's control and you just adapt. And what we found is that through doing more online stuff, I do the YouTube videos, we do Facebook live streams, we've got the podcasts and the lectures that go up, is that it's meant that a wider audience is becoming aware of our way of putting across the Buddha's teaching. Because the way we put across the Buddha's teaching is not the way the Buddha's teaching is put across everywhere. And there's room for us all. We are a westernized form of Buddhism that emphasizes what the Buddha originally taught, Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. And we do so in a pragmatic way, free of the more exotic religious connotations. That's not going to appeal to everyone, but it is hopefully, and perhaps it appeals to people that would otherwise have dismissed Buddhism, but who now have an entry point to it because of the way it's being put across. I have no personal desire to be well known. I just want to concentrate my mind. I want to go inward, not outward.
Yeah.
And so you're on that threshold that so when you meditate, you just have to be very, very clear that this is inward time, and then there'll be outward time.
Yes.
And so you just adapt.
Yeah.
So it's been fun. I love doing the live streams because, I don't know, it's just a unique way of contributing, really.
I think that's what's really impressed me as a kind of newcomer coming into the community is noticing how good you are and others are at adapting to new situations. And that's, for me, that's the teaching kind of coming to the fore, because it's, you know, you're leading by example there.
I mean, if we're panicking because it turns out life isn't under our control, then we shouldn't be running a Buddhist center.
Yes.
So surely we're the people that people turn to because the instability underlying all our assumptions about the stable nature of life has become evident.
Yeah.
And you want people that are calm. And you are far more likely to listen to what they have to say if they're demonstrating genuinely that they're calm and they're not put out by this and they are able to adapt without biting people's heads off. You know, and that is the outcome of, it's the Buddha's teaching. It's, and the Buddha's teaching is simply a description of reality and the way life works. So if you are, you know, life has its ups and downs, but if you are living in accordance with Dhamma, with truth, then you are able to move up with the ups and move down with the downs, and knowing that it's all transient. The good times have to come back because bad times have to end.
Yes.
Everything arises, and you just develop this equanimity.
Yes.
Through not just thinking about it, but actually observing it. That's the difference. Yeah. That's what the true Buddha's teaching is.
Yeah. And not too much speculation or kind of forecasting what's going to happen, but more interesting.
Yeah, the sun's going to go supernova. We're going to be swallowed up. You know? So what's the point in... You don't have to speculate. When you know that your actions have results and you live in accordance with that and you find out which, from experience, which are the actions that produce the suffering and which are the actions that produce the happiness, just keep doing the latter. Then it doesn't matter what the economic situation is. Then it doesn't matter what the environmental situation is.
Mm.
And life does involve more than just this one human life.
Yeah.
So this isn't all there is.
Yeah.
There is more to life than meets the eye.
Yeah.
And that's what you discover through following the way.
Yeah.
It's not a blind belief in something. It's a genuine comprehension.
Mm. Okay, well, thank you for that. Is there anything you'd like to add about the kind of primary reason that we came here, which was to talk about monastic living? Is there anything else you'd like to add about that?
Well, I mean, how have you found it? Just to turn it back on you.
Thanks.
So how long have you actually been ordained?
So I ordained in February, mid February, so just over 6 months now.
And you were in what, 3 months before that?
Little over 3 months, yeah. So yeah, it's. I think people often ask me, was it very different, post-ordination than before? And I would say not massively. I didn't notice a huge shift at that time. But I would say, on balance, the things that I've found most beneficial are not the things that I thought would be helping me when I first came in.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So I thought it would be the meditation practice would be the central thing. And I'm not downplaying the importance of that, but certainly, you know, if you think about how I kind of came to the centre originally, attending retreats, experiencing the benefits of the sitting practice, I think I just did a bit of maths in my head and thought, well, if I do more of that,
fair enough, yeah,
then it will all be, everything will be great. And then I suppose coming in, it is the practice, but it is so much about the sort of day to day and what sort of stories come up in your head when you do things, say, for instance, repetitive tasks or things that you know, I don't think there's any other time in my life where I've done one task so many times on a sort of consistent basis. And I suppose for me, that brings up, like I say, narratives or stories in the head, and then being aware of those stories, and kind of what you said kind of just a moment ago about understanding your suffering, really, like how you can make something difficult for yourself by the story that you tell yourself about it. Yeah. And I had an intimation of it, but I never would have known that unless I'd come in.
Yes. Sitting is only part of the puzzle.
Yeah.
And I think people can get, I mean, we do a lot of sitting here. You know, we sit 4 or 5 hours of meditation, the full timers sit for 4 or 5 hours of meditation every day.
Mm.
Not all in one go. But there is a very definite structure. I found that structure, the daily structure, the daily routine, to be so helpful because it meant to a certain extent I didn't have to think for myself.
Mm.
That I knew I had to be there at that time. All right, well, I was there at that time.
Mm.
So that discipline was important. But it also meant that you got into the after breakfast morning duty. It would be repetitive. Mm. You would be doing the same thing every day.
Mm.
But that enables mindfulness.
Mm.
So because you have that structure and you have the schedule, that is really helpful to after all, what is our overarching aim? It's to realize the true nature of reality through direct exploration of our experience. You don't have to be sat in a chair to do that.
Mm.
It's just when you're sat in a chair, you're able to develop your concentration more, certainly, but your mindfulness can be developed at any time.
Mm.
So it's recognizing the value of that structure and having that schedule there and knowing, yes, there are repetitive tasks. But, I mean, I discovered when I was, you know, cleaning the front door for the umpteenth time this week or whatever, and trying to find specks of dust or whatever, but actually it was never the same moment of touch. It was never the same moment of hearing. It was never the same moment of... And realised, no, I've never actually done this before. This is it. Life is always new. And those are the insights that come. And you discover that... I mean, after all, I mean, what... If you've caught on to this notion that there is a transcendent aspect to life and that the problem is everyone keeps ignoring it, then what is the most important thing in life? Does it matter that you're washing the same door that you washed yesterday or dusting the same room that you dusted yesterday? It literally doesn't matter because you've got an overarching purpose.
Yeah.
And so therefore the structure is really, really helpful.
Yeah. And attempting to achieve or recognize that level of awareness and mindfulness in the daily life, in the daily round outside of the monastery, is very difficult because of the distractions.
Yes, it can be done. People have done it as lay people, gone all the way through the training, but not without proper instruction and not without commitment and not without coming on retreats twice a year. And you know, so they do the very next best thing.
Yeah,
but you cannot replicate full-time training.
No.
In terms of a fully rounded experiential understanding plus an understanding of the books,
yes,
you know, a really good understanding of the suttas of Abhidhamma, you can't beat full-time training. And underlying it all is this tremendous sense of having been properly orientated in the world and having a direction and a real sense of purpose.
Yeah.
So I was getting up every day.
Yeah.
I was going to bed after the last meditation in the evening. I'd reach points where I was going, oh, all I've got to do now is just go to bed. You know, it's like everything was in order.
Yeah.
And then all that's going to happen is I'm going to get up in the morning and there's now another opportunity to practice mindfulness.
Yeah.
So if you're into it,
yeah,
it's the best.
Yeah.
It really is the best way to live your life.
Yes. I think that's a really good point to end on, is that?
Yeah.
Great, thank you.
Well, that's great.
The Orkana Trust is a registered charity which oversees the running of two Buddhist monasteries and a meditation centre, the House of Inner Tranquility. We provide instruction in the Buddha's path to enlightenment all the way from introductory workshops, regular meetings and retreats, to full-time monastic training. Anyone interested in finding out more can come to our website at Orkana, that's aukana.org.uk. In addition to these podcasts, we also have a House of Inner Tranquility YouTube channel with videos dealing with all aspects of the Buddha's teaching. And you can keep in touch via Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. If you have any questions you would like answered in future editions of this discussion show, then please post them on any of our social media accounts, or you can contact us directly by email from our website.